Historical Context, Adam Smith and Wealth of Nations, was presented by David Crabtree on August 10, 2009, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in reduced sound quality for the first few minutes of the teaching.
The general cultural perspective is that education is done for the student, and from our perspective, that's not education. That education is something that the student does, that only a student can learn. You can't be learned, as they say in some. So we have done whatever we can within the curriculum of Gutenberg to throw the responsibility of learning back on the student. And that's something that we do in the Summer Institute as well. And I hope that you will sense the feeling of responsibility that we're placing on your shoulders. The topic that we have this year is basically having to do with economics, as is in keeping with the Gutenberg perspective and our approach to learning. All of those who are teaching don't know much about it. None of us are specialists in economics. We will be reading from the economy. We will be reading them and discussing them. They are the ones that are providing us with the ideas, and we are going to kick them around with you. And so the result is both you and we will be learning from the economists together. What you are likely to learn over the course of the week is going to be different from what the person sitting next to you is likely to learn over the course of the week. What you learn will be idiosyncratic to you on the basis of what information you already come with, what your experience has been, what your interests are. What we want to do is throw a lot of stuff at you. And it's your job to kind of sort through that, think about stuff, churn it over, and learn whatever seems to be most appropriate for you to learn. At the end of the week, you probably will be able to list specifically some things that you learned, but more likely what will happen is you will have a whole different set of questions that you have in your mind with respect to economics. Questions that you didn't have before, and I would consider that a huge success. So this is not going to be at all like an economics course. We aren't going to talk about the kinds of things that are talked about in economics class the way that they are typically talked about in an economics class. We are more interested in much bigger questions. Questions like, what is wealth? What is an economy? How do we think about these things? What value do they have? And most importantly for us is, does the Bible have anything to say with respect to this kind? And how can we think biblically about wealth and economics and what the role plays in our lives as human beings? How will this work? How is it laid out? Every day will be approximately the same. We'll start out with a brief lecture giving background information with respect to the great books reading that you will do that day, discussion will have. Then there will be a discussion. The first discussion each day will be on the basis of a reading with respect to economics from one of the great books authors. So then there'll be a discussion of the great books author, and you'll be divided up into smaller groups for those discussions. After that discussion, we'll reconvene and have a brief lecture on that particular reading. Then we will break for lunch. Then after lunch, once again, you'll be broken up into smaller groups, and we will discuss readings from the Bible. And after those discussions, there will be another lecture on those particular passages that you've just discussed. Then at the end of the day, there will be a question and answer session. The question and answer sessions, from my perspective, are very important. That's your opportunity to pursue the kinds of things that you are particularly interested in, that questions that have been raised throughout the course of the day that you haven't had a chance to explore. So as the day progresses, if you would jot down questions that come to you, to mind, that would be great. And then the question and answer period is hopefully a free-flowing discussion, and you can raise those questions then. Then at
of course, at the end of the week, in Gutenberg fashion, there will be a 3-hour oral exam. Let me give you a little bit of background information on Adam Smith, and then we'll go talk about him. They say that generals are always fighting the last war. Economists are always fighting the last depression. Economics is not a fixed thing in the sense that the economic environment is constantly changing. If you think about it, every consumer is in one way or another contributing to the economy. Every producer is contributing to the economy. Every credit card company is contributing to the economy. And all of those people are doing various things, and they keep doing different things as they are going about their business. And as you have billions of people doing different things, innovating, changing, they are all changing the economy. As a result, the economy is this thing that is so big, so complicated, and there is so much happening that no one really knows about. No one has the whole in mind. No one can have the whole in mind. As a result, the economy is a very complex thing that's changing very rapidly, and even economists today don't understand today's economy. And that becomes clear as you read the economists. They're always running, trying to catch up. Some of them are quite confident that they've caught up. Others are more humble and realize that they haven't. In the talk with respect to our recent economic downturn, everybody is talking about the last depression and what worked then. But if you read the works of serious historians about the last depression, it is still not clear to scholars what happened and why. Any confident answers that are given with respect to that question are overconfident. Three things that I'd like to point out with respect to economics that I think are important. The first one, economic realities are always changing. The second is, much about economics is counterintuitive. And we'll talk about that more over the course of the week. And the third thing is, in economics, appearances are often more important than reality. Economics is highly psychological. Adam Smith was the first significant author to try to come up with a comprehensive understanding of an economy and how it works. The full title of the book that the reading is from is An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. The main question that he's interested in is, what is wealth and where does it come from? I think that's a fascinating question. I did take a few economics classes when I was in college. I have, like most of my college education, forgotten almost all of it. But this is a question that, if I had free time, it's one that I would like to pursue. Try to think through, what is an economy from the ground up, block by block? What is an economy? How does it work? And how is wealth generated? What kind of thing is it? Adam Smith was writing at a time when the economy was beginning to change very rapidly after a period of time when the economy had not changed rapidly for probably forever. It hadn't changed rapidly. He's writing at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. His book first came out the year of the American Revolution, 1776. So he is looking around him, looking at all of the changes that are happening relatively quickly. And he's seeing quite a few changes, as is everyone else who's paying attention to the economy at all. There is a distinction that's often made in economics classes between microeconomics and macroeconomics. Microeconomics is dealing with economics on a small scale, so at the factory level. How is price determined? And how do the costs of production fit into all this, et cetera, et cetera? Macroeconomics looks at the national level. What difference does interest rates make? What does a change in the money supply do? Those kinds of issues. Prior to Adam Smith, no one had really paid much attention to macroeconomics. There were people who had thought about microeconomics, but at the macroeconomic level, very little had been done, because macroeconomics wasn't really a force until the Industrial Revolution kicked in. But with the Industrial Revolution, the economy booms. relatively speaking, things are changing very quickly. They're seeing things they'd never seen before. And as a result, it is as if the whole world has changed. I meant to get this exact quote, but I forgot to write it down. But Karl Marx, who we'll be reading for tomorrow, wrote in the Communist Manifesto, with respect to this period when the Industrial Revolution is happening, he said, everything that was solid melted into air. It's as if everything that was assumed to be rock solid true about the world, and especially with respect to economics, that's all just evaporating on them. And the question is, now where do we stand? What's solid? What can we count on? The Industrial Revolution is the period of industrialization that occurs at the end of the feudal period. The feudal period lasts from, and there we're going to attach all kinds of dates to it depending on exactly what we're talking about, but let's say 600 to 1300. That's typically a period of time that's associated with the feudal system. Then from 1300 till about 1800, the feudal system is dying away and is being transformed into the modern era. So it takes a long time for the feudal system to completely be transformed. But prior to the Industrial Revolution, the feudal system is falling apart, it's being transformed, and one of the changes that's happening that people are seeing very clearly is that military developments are taking place, significant military developments. Armies become much more expensive because they are bigger and they require a lot more equipment. And in particular, we're talking about guns. So military strength is becoming expensive. As a result, what they're discovering throughout Europe is money is the key to survival. If you don't have money, you can't afford a military that will keep you competitive in a very competitive environment, that is Europe. So this they understand. You've got to have money and you have to have lots of it. But the question is, how do you maximize your opportunity to accumulate wealth in order to be able to afford a modern army? There wasn't really a system of understanding, a comprehensive system of understanding that existed at the time, but there were a loose set of assumptions about the economy that were put together into what was called mercantile economics. And the main set of assumptions for mercantile economics was, first of all, wealth is gold, well, gold or silver, but wealth is precious metal. If you want to know how much wealth someone has, you count their gold. If you want to know how much wealth a nation has, you count the gold that the government has or the king has in his possession. An underlying assumption of this is that wealth is limited. If I take wealth from you, you have less and I have more. The second assumption is that a positive balance of trade is important. That is to say that our nation needs to sell more to other nations than we import from other nations. We want to be selling more elsewhere and getting for that more gold that we can stick in our bank vault and therefore be wealthier. Third assumption, you need to tax heavily. If the government or the king is going to have a lot of wealth, he needs to get it wherever he can. One of his sources of wealth is going to be taxation, or tariff is another form of wealth acquisition. But that's important, so we can get the money out of the hands of people who are going to waste it and get it into the hands of the person who can use it to pay for a military. The fourth assumption is that the government should play a key role in regulating the economy. It is clear to everyone that that which is planned and controlled is better than that which is unplanned and chaotic. So if you want the economy to work well, then the government needs to exercise the control that it can in order for that to be done right. Now, we're talking about the 1700s. In the 1700s, the government didn't have the tools available to it to carry out much control of a national economy. It just didn't have the resources. It didn't have the manpower. It didn't have the technology. So the assumption was that it's good for the government to do that. The reality was the government wasn't in a position, for the most part, to do much of that. And some countries could do it more than others. Spain, for instance, had greater resources, and as a result, the Spanish government was more intrusive in the economic life of Spain than in England, where the government had very few resources, and although it would like to have intruded, it just couldn't. Now, with the things that are happening in the Industrial Revolution, these assumptions are being called into question. It's not so clear that these assumptions are true. One of the examples that everyone could look at was the nation of Spain. When the New World was discovered, Spain acquired vast colonies in the Americas. And the reason that Spain agreed to funding Columbus's trip in the first place was the promise of wealth. He was going to find gold and spices and everything nices to bring back and sell in Europe. So when it became clear that Columbus had not made his way to the Far East, it still remained the object, the goal of the Spanish government to extract as much wealth as it could from the lands that had been found. And so getting gold and silver was their primary objective. And they did. There was a significant amount of gold and silver that was found in South America, South and Central America, and that was shipped across the Atlantic back to Spain so it could go into the king's vault. He took, I think it's 1/4 of all of the gold that was acquired in colonies, went into the king's vault. You would think then Spain got obscenely wealthy, and you would think that that would mean that Spain would have enormous resources at its command and that it would dominate Europe. But in a relatively short period of time, what they discovered is that huge influx of gold caused an enormous amount of inflation. Everything cost more. In Spain in particular, but that was true all over Europe. It spread all throughout Europe. And what observers discovered is the gold would go to Spain initially, and the king, a lot of that would go into the king's vaults, but he would give it out to his noblemen, and his noblemen were involved in the gold trade, and they got wealthy on that, but they wanted to live like wealthy people live, and in order to live like wealthy people live, you have to buy wealthy type things, and Spain didn't produce them. So they were using gold to buy stuff that they wanted, and they would use it to buy it from other countries. So what countries were enjoying the most rapid increase in their standard of living? It was England and Holland, because they were producing the things that Spaniards wanted, fabrics in particular. So Spain didn't benefit from this gold, this windfall profits of gold that they received, and the question was, why is this happening? Does gold equal wealth? Does wealth equal gold? Let me read a couple of paragraphs from a book by Niall Ferguson called The Ascent of Money. And he's answering this particular question. What happened to Spain? They dug up so much silver to pay for their wars of conquest that the metal itself dramatically declined in value. That is to say, in its purchasing power with respect to other goods. During the so-called price revolutions, which affected all of Europe from the 1540s until the 1640s, the cost of food, which had shown no sustained upward trend for 300 years, rose markedly. In England, the country for which we have the best price data, the cost of living increased by a factor of 7 in the same period. Not a high rate of inflation these days, on average about 2% per year, but a revolutionary increase in the price of bread by medieval standards. Within Spain, the abundance of silver also acted as a resource curse, like the abundant oil of Arabia, Nigeria, Persia, Russia, and Venezuela in our own time, removing the incentives for more productive economic activity, while at the same time strengthening rent-seeking autocrats at the expense of representative assemblies. What the Spaniards had failed to understand is that the value of precious metal is not absolute. Money is worth only what someone else is willing to give you for it. An increase in its supply will not make a society richer, though it may enrich the government that monopolizes the production of money. Other things being equal, monetary expansion will merely make prices higher. So this is the background to the Wealth of Nations. And these are the kinds of questions that Adam Smith is exploring. He's trying to figure out, where does wealth come from? On what basis can a nation call itself wealthy? And what does that wealth consist? And in particular, and he's always got in the back of his mind, the mercantile assumptions. And his question is, are those assumptions valid? So that's what he's exploring, and that's the background to the reading that we'll be discussing.